This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty, calling the climate right. The U.S. Wednesday appealed for a ceasefire in Yemen and for the combatants to return to UN-backed peace talks to end more than 3 years of war. Author and former UN Security Council Yemen Panel of Experts member Gregory Johnson said there are two reasons for this renewed effort.
One, of course, is the death of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist who was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. I think that's brought a lot of criticism down on Saudi Arabia, and in particular Mohammed bin Salman,
the crown prince. Johnson also said there's growing opposition in Congress to end military support for the Saudi-led coalition, largely over the large number of civilian casualties. UN spokesman Farhan Haq said special UN envoy to Yemen, Martin Griffiths, welcomed the U.S. decision.
The special envoy will continue to work with all parties to agree on tangible steps to spare all Yemenis the disastrous consequences of further conflict and to urgently address the political, security, and humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
Griffiths in Yemen in September is described to have made progress in prodding both sides, the Shia Houthi rebels and Saudi-led coalition, to end hostilities. Houthi political council member Sultan al-Samay insisted the Houthis are not the aggressors and are ready for peace when aggression against them is stopped. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis has called for a ceasefire in 30 days, adding the Saudis and United Arab Emirates are ready to embrace U.N. efforts to achieve a negotiated settlement. Members of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria Wednesday said more than 40 of its members were killed in clashes with security forces in the capital, Abuja. Many were buried the same day. Ibrahim Gamawa is a Shia leader.
I, as a Shia today, I'm carrying my death certificate because under Buhari's government, any Shia in Nigeria is under a threat.
Shia members are demanding the release of their leader, Ibrahim Zakzaki, incarcerated since 2015. This is VOA News. President Donald Trump Wednesday said as many as 15,000 U.S. troops will go to the southern U.S. border with Mexico to bolster Border Patrol officers and the National Guard to stop a series of caravans of thousands of Central American migrants from entering the U.S. illegally. Mr. Trump spoke about it during a campaign speech late Wednesday in Florida.
We're tougher than anybody. We're tougher than any force, and we're probably going to have to be, unfortunately. I tell them, turn back, and they're not going to be released. It's called catch, but we take the word release out. We're not releasing anymore.
Thousands of migrants, mostly from Honduras, are moving slowly northward in Mexico after more than 2 weeks on the road. They're trying to negotiate the use of buses. Meanwhile, at least two smaller caravans of migrants have left El Salvador, heading northward. In Syria, the U.S.-backed Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces said Turkish attacks have forced them to temporarily suspend their campaign against Islamic State. Turkey considers the YPG militia to be a terrorist organization. The U.S. has called on Ankara to de-escalate the situation. Meanwhile, the U.N. has announced veteran Norwegian diplomat Herr Petersen will become the new envoy to Syria, replacing Stefan de Mistura, who announced he's stepping down next month. Istanbul's chief prosecutor, Irfan Fidan, said Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was strangled as soon as he entered the Saudi consulate in the Turkish city October 2nd. He said it was part of a premeditated scheme after which his body was dismembered and removed. His office said discussions with the Saudi chief prosecutor over the killing have yielded no concrete results. The number of child charges filed against accused mass killer Robert Bowers has been increased from 29 to 44 following Saturday's killing of 11 people at the Tree of Life Jewish Temple in Pittsburgh. Prosecutors intend to seek the death penalty. Meanwhile, three more funerals were held for the victims of the mass shooting. The head of the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt, was in Pittsburgh urging political leaders to tone down inflammatory rhetoric.
We saw a marked increase last year, 57%. Including a spike of almost 100% in K-12 schools and 90% in colleges and universities. We need our leaders to lead and ratchet back the kind of rhetoric that emboldens extremists and to speak out unequivocally when there's intolerance.
The ADL said Saturday's attack was the deadliest targeting Jews in U.S. history. The U.N. Security Council said its backing plans for talks on the future of Western Sahara while voting to extend for 6 months its mission in the disputed North African territory. Stocks on Wall Street ended the month and day Wednesday up, with the benchmark Dow Jones rising over 240 points to 25,115. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan factions recommit to peace as they celebrated the signing of the recent peace agreement.
We want to prove to you that we have a strong political commitment to restore our country. If there is someone who has not attended the celebration, go and tell them that you have seen it with your own eyes.
The South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar speaking yesterday in Juba through an interpreter. The DRC opposition says it is making progress in finding a consensus candidate for the December 23rd presidential election. The World Health Organization disavows a self-proclaimed Zimbabwe HIV healer. And Nigerian Shiite Muslims accuse the Nigerian army of killing dozens of their protesters.
On Saturday, six people were gunned down by the Nigerian army during the peaceful procession. 33 people were killed on Monday by the Nigerian soldiers. And yesterday, 7 people were killed by the Nigerian police, backed by the Nigerian army.
Ibrahim Gamanwad is the spokesperson for the Islamic Movement of Nigeria. We'll look at the causes of early marriages in Guinea-Bissau, and an African filmmaker tells the tales of South African migrants. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudanese Wednesday celebrated the signing of their recent peace agreement in the capital Juba. Riek Machar, leader of the main rebel Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition SPLIO, returned to Juba for the first time since 2016 to take part in the ceremony. South Sudan President Salva Kiir used the occasion to pardon two prisoners of war, one of them James Gadet. Here is John Tanza of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program.
James Gadet is Riek Machar's spokesman, who was arrested and deported from Kenya in 2016. Gadet received a death sentence. Kiir said he would also free a former South African colonel, John Endley, who was Machar's security advisor and received a death sentence on charges of spying on South Sudan.
We're still working with the agencies to find out if there are still more prisoners of war to be released. And in this occasion, I want to announce before you that we have two people whom I'm releasing now. One of them is called James Gadet.
The president also ordered all security operatives to allow humanitarian agencies to operate freely in South Sudan. The leader of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, Riek Machar, traveled from Khartoum with 50 members of his party to attend the celebration.
President Kiir invited us, all of us in the opposition, so that we can come and celebrate with you here in Juba. We first said the agreement said we will be going to Juba after 8 months. But if there's a celebration like this, who will not attend?
The rebel leader says his group is serious about the September 12 peace deal. He says his presence in Juba is a sign that he wants peace.
Why are we here today? If we come after 8 months, some of you will say we don't want peace. We want peace. Our heart is on peace like you. As I can see, some of you are dancing.
Machar insisted that his party will implement the peace deal and will end violence across South Sudan.
We want to prove to you that we have a strong political commitment to restore our country. If there is someone who has not attended the celebration, go and tell them that you have seen it with your own eyes.
Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir told the South Sudanese that Sudan will continue to help the leaders in South Sudan to implement the peace agreement. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni also addressed dignitaries at the celebrations. He cautioned South Sudanese leaders against using violence to solve their problems.
I'm very happy to be here to join you in celebrating peace, which we signed in Khartoum the other day. I congratulate the parties, His Excellency Salva Kiir, representing the SPLM in government, and Dr. Riek Machar and the others, representing the opposition. Thank you very much for attending to logic in the end and signing this peace agreement.
Ugandan leader has been involved in South Sudan conflict. In 2013, he sent Ugandan troops to help South Sudan army fight Machar's forces. The leader of the South Sudan opposition alliance, Gabriel Changson, warned President Kiir to be serious this time around.
You have been speaking loud and clear that you are standing with the people of South Sudan. If that is true, then you stand with the people of South Sudan by supporting this agreement, because this agreement will end their suffering. And not only that, there is a lot of money being spent on the humanitarian services in South Sudan, on IDPs, on refugees. That money can be cut into half or even more than half if you support the peace process.
Changson urged South Sudanese to monitor the peace agreement and report any violations.
That was John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reporting here in Washington. A spokesman for the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, representing Nigeria's Shiite Muslims, is accusing Nigerian security forces of killing dozens of their protesters since last Sunday. Ibrahim Gamawa says security forces opened fire with live bullets on Wednesday on protesters who were marching to demand the release of their leader, Ibrahim Zazaki, who has been in jail since 2015. Gamawa says as many as 42 demonstrators were killed over 2 days of protest, but the Nigerian army said only 3 people were killed and 400 arrested. Gamawa also refutes claims by the Nigerian army that the protesters were throwing petrol bombs and carrying what the army called dangerous weapons.
On Saturday, 6 people were gunned down by the Nigerian army during the peaceful procession. 33 people were killed on Monday by the Nigerian soldiers. And yesterday, 7 people were killed by the Nigerian police, backed by the Nigerian army. Today, we were able to bury 33 out of the dead. Inshallah, tomorrow we are going to bury the rest. The corpses are deposited in various hospitals, but God willing, we will go and collect the dead bodies today.
Let me say, Ibrahim, the armed say that this took place because some of you, the protesters, were throwing petrol bombs, as well as you had some dangerous weapons.
Let me correct you. I think the killing on Saturday, the army said they were transferring some weapons from one of their barracks in a different state, and then we blocked their way, and we try as much as possible to intercept the weapons. Now, if we are to answer them one after the other, the police will use petrol bombs to against them. But the Nigerian army that we went to collect weapons by force, we didn't carry anything. They say we only throw them with stones. That is ridiculous. You know, if we are ready to go and intercept arms from the Nigerian army, arms that we don't know what type of arms are they, I think we need to be well armed for us to do that. We can't go with women, children, and the aged among us to go and intercept weapons from the Nigerian army. That is irresponsible, that is fabricated, that is laughable, that is out of sense for any reasonable person, let alone an officer in the Nigerian army, to make that ridiculous claim. And they said we set a police car ablaze. And we told them that, look, if I told you we were to set cars ablaze, we were getting to 1 million yesterday. We were 800,000+. We would have set all their cars ablaze. Why one car? And why not other cars if we are out for rampage? And if we are armed and we want to retaliate to what they are doing, we would have killed, if not all of them, because there are not as many as 3,000 policemen.
Ibrahim, I know the protest is about perhaps your leader who was arrested and is in jail.
Sorry?
Sheikh Zakzaki. What's the status now?
Definitely, he is not in a good shape. He lost an eye, and at the same time, there are bullets lodging in his body. And he has high blood pressure. What we learned that the most times his medication was denied, the authorities denying him his medication in Kaduna. So the situation is very pathetic. His wife, too, is carrying bullet wounds in her body. Sometimes the government will not allow even a visit from the family for months, and their medication is being denied.
So nice to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm grateful. Thank you.
Ibrahim Gamawa is the spokesman for the Islamic Movement of Nigeria. You're speaking with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 1st. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. An opposition leader in the Democratic Republic of Congo says the opposition is making progress in finding a consensus candidate for the December 23rd presidential election. Opposition party leaders met last week in South Africa to choose a unified candidate to challenge Emmanuel Ramazani Shadary, President Joseph Kabila's handpicked candidate. Some of the viable opposition candidates, like Jean-Pierre Bemba, Moise Katumbi and former Prime Minister Adolphe Muzito, have already been disqualified by the Electoral Commission. Freddy Matungulu, leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party, says the opposition wants to avoid the mistakes it made in the last two presidential elections when it failed to come up with a single candidate. He says the opposition hopes to agree on a single candidate by the 15th of November.
The truth of the matter is that we have four major candidates that are still running. Three have been invalidated by the government. And as we speak now, we are having bilateral discussions between us after the consultations we had last week in South Africa. The idea is to come to a consensus on that single candidate before the 15th of November, and we are really working on this.
Today, Thursday, is the 1st of November. You have more than a month to go before the election. Do you think you will be able to put it together, have a candidate that the people of the DRC can know before the election?
I think, yeah, that's absolutely certain. We made a lot of progress in our discussions in South Africa, in Pretoria last week. As you probably know, we were there between the 23rd and 25th. Focusing on precisely this particular issue, among other problems that this electoral process is facing, and on coming to a consensus on the single candidacy, I think I can report that we made a lot of progress. Everybody was there, all the seven groups were represented, and the idea is to continue and finalize these discussions next week.
You said you made progress. Some of your leading candidates have been disqualified by the Senate. Jean-Pierre Bemba, Katumbi, who do you have now?
We are still working together. When I talk about the group of seven, this is the group that is led by Katumbi, Jean-Pierre Bemba, Muzito, myself, that is Matungulu, Felix Tshisekedi Fayulu, and Vital Kamerhe. All of us, the seven, are working together to try to come to a consensus on a single candidate from the four that are still running. And the four that are still running, as you certainly know, are Felix Tshisekedi, Vital Kamerhe, Martin Fayulu, and myself, that is Freddy Matungulu.
And do you think you can come up with a single candidate?
Personally, I'm very optimistic about this, you know, because we are working, learning from the lessons of the mistakes that the opposition actually made in 2006 and in 2011. And that is the lack of unity when we went to the polls in 2006 and 2011, which resulted in Kabila still continuing. And I think today everybody is aware that it's going to be extremely difficult to win if we do not do this as a group. And that's what we're trying to do.
Freddy Matungulu is the leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party. He was speaking with me from the DRC capital, Kinshasa. The United Nations has squashed a claim by a self-proclaimed prophet in Zimbabwe who claims to have discovered a cure for HIV and AIDS. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, the World Health Organization is encouraging millions of Zimbabweans to continue with their antiretroviral treatment, or ART.
Over the weekend, a self-proclaimed prophet called Walter Magaya told his followers that he had discovered a cure to HIV and AIDS, bringing temporary relief to millions of Zimbabweans on antiretroviral treatment, or those failing to be on medication as the country is cash-strapped. But late on Wednesday, Dr. Alex Gasasira, the World Health Organization head in Zimbabwe, weighed in.
There's currently no cure for HIV, but we have effective antiretroviral treatment that helps prevent progression of HIV infection and helps people with HIV infection to live healthier, long and productive lives, and prevents transmission of HIV from individual to individual.
Magaya has been flighting adverts on social media asking people infected with the HIV virus to buy his drugs, which have an asking price of $1,000 in cash. For an economy of Zimbabwe, that is a lot of money for many people. Never mind the fact that the so-called cure of HIV virus and AIDS has not been scientifically tested in Zimbabwe as required by the law. But Magaya is digging in.
We tested it and it's perfect. God showed me a certain tree. He showed me some certain people and he linked me as well with our Indian counterparts. For me to stand in front of the world and say that we have found the cure for HIV and cancer. So my biggest problem is going to be journalists, because there's this instinct inside every journalist here that nothing good can come out of Africa. I know even if I've said that I'm going to give my government a chance, no one will write that. They will write things that will try to create controversy. No one will write things to celebrate.
Zimbabwe's government has since asked Magaya to stop his claims that he has discovered an HIV virus and AIDS cure. President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government says all new medical drugs have to go through rigorous tests by the Medicines Control Authority of Zimbabwe before being declared safe for use by human beings. Zimbabwe is one of the most affected countries in Africa by HIV and AIDS. The situation would have been worse had it not been for financial assistance from international organizations such as the Global Fund, the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, and UN agencies like the World Health Organization and UNAIDS. Over 1 million people living in Zimbabwe with the HIV virus are on antiretroviral treatment. According to the UN, this has led to the reduction of AIDS-related deaths by 63% between 2010 and 2017. Columbus Mavunga, for VOA's Daybreak Africa, Harare.
Nearly 37% of women in Guinea-Bissau get married before the age of 18, and Planned International, a child rights NGO, recently conducted a study trying to figure out the root causes of child marriage in the country. The organization's Guinea-Bissau director, Sarah Joel Sidi, talked to Ricky Stryak about the context and possible solutions surrounding child marriage.
For us, the most important thing is really to understand the drivers, really. What drives child marriage from the perspective of the communities, so that we can really try and develop responses, try and develop strategies to respond to child marriage, because it's a great barrier for the development of girls particularly.
What are some of the main drivers of child marriage?
Yes, I think the two critical ones. First one is that parents are really concerned with the sexuality of girls, for example. They really don't want their children to start having sexual relationship and getting pregnant out of wedlock, you know, because that is seen as a shame, as a irresponsible parenting. And then, you know, you lose respect and status inside your own community if you've seen not firm or not able to manage, you know, the sexuality of your children and getting them pregnant before they are at the age of marriage.
So is it even more the idea of getting pregnant outside of wedlock than the idea of them being sexually active that is more of a driver?
Yes, I think so. That's really more of a driver. I think the problem in the past was that there was no contraceptive available. I mean, young girls did know how to control, their periods, and they got pregnant very often. And that really is something that the communities don't like to happen. And they really, that's really one of the critical drivers. But another one also is that most parents, particularly those in the remote rural areas, do not foresee any future beyond their own life experiences. You know, somebody who's been a subsistence farmer for most of their lives or most of their, you know, ancestors don't anticipate really having a daughter who is who follows a different career path. So that they try to really have them married very close to where, you know, have them live and close to where they are so that they can build this work of support and around them as well. Because when they grow older, you know, they have their daughters around, they have their sons around so that, you know, they can look after them. They can continue the lineage and the lifestyle that they know. I mean, it's a lot more complex and deeper than actually we can imagine.
That was Sarah Hall-City, country director in Guinea-Bissau for Plan International, who was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Bissau. The film Via from Nigerian-born director Akin Omotoso tells the story of three people who journey from their rural homes in South Africa to Johannesburg. As Mike O'Sullivan reports, it is a story of migration that deals with universal themes.
It is a story of lost innocence and betrayal.
Via tells the story of three strangers who get on a train, each of them with a mission to fulfill in Johannesburg. They're coming from Durban to Johannesburg. They never meet, but their stories are intertwined.
Each traveler has a mission, and each faces rejection, abuse, or violence. This coming-of-age film originated from real stories of South Africans in the Homeless Writers Project, a workshop for people living on the streets. Via means to go in the dialect of South African townships.
It takes on several meanings. So to go, they're leaving Durban to go to Johannesburg, but then when you get there, you know, maybe people don't want you to leave, so they want you to go, you know. So it really covers the spirit of the projects.
Omotoso is a migrant himself. He was born in Nigeria, but his family moved to South Africa, where he studied drama. Then he worked as an actor and director. Via is one of 20 films from filmmakers of color and women directors distributed by Array, an arts collective and distribution company founded by Hollywood filmmaker Ava DuVernay.
Our purpose is to make sure that audiences have access to films they otherwise would not see, those independent voices that deserve a platform for stories to be told.
Via has played at international festivals and opened at theaters in the United States in October. It will also stream on Netflix starting November 1st. The director says this South Africa-based film tells a story that many can relate to.
I always say everyone has a cousin who's arriving, or a brother who's leaving, or somebody who's coming. So Via is able to tap into, I guess, something that doesn't just happen in Johannesburg.
It taps into universal themes, adds the director, the search for a better life and the struggle for survival. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa News. A spokesman for the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, representing Nigeria's Shiite Muslims, is accusing Nigerian security forces of killing dozens of their protesters since last Sunday. And that is it for this Thursday, November 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music, and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.